Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Katie Galley, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And Katie, I noticed something this morning that was different than last week.
What did you notice?
You're purposely not telling me what you do in the weekend in case I ask you what you do this weekend.
On air. Yeah, yes. I got to keep you, you know, on your feet, on
so
your toes.
So what'd you do this weekend?
on Saturday, I went hiking. That was fun. Well, it was kind of more walking, not hiking. And so that was good. And I went to see my friend. She lives in Decatur. We went walking around downtown Decatur.
Oh, that's fun.
That was fun. It was nice down there.
One of my favorite things.
There's a book festival next weekend there.
That's right.
We went there. Yeah.
Decatur Book Festival.
For the
big one.
Labor Day. Yeah. I went there last year. It's really cool.
Yep.
So I did that. And yeah, I kind of worked out on Saturday. The gym coached.
As always, how was coaching?
It's good. Super fun.
Love coaching. Changing lives.
I don't know. Maybe.
Well, we're changing lives in here.
Yeah, for sure.
And here we get to tell the stories of business that's happening here in Atlanta. And we got quite the crew today.
We do.
We're going to kick it off with Aaron Hilligus, and he's with Big Nerd Ranch. And then we're going to get to Jim Crone with a crew insurance. And then we're going to close with Sam Ofer with Ideal Diamond.
Cool. I'm excited.
All right. So let's kick it off. Aaron, welcome to Atlanta Business Radio. Tell us a little bit about Big Nerd Ranch. How are you serving folks?
So Big Nerd Ranch does mobile development application, and we do training on how to do mobile app development. So we work closely with product managers at different companies and bring their fantasies to fruition.
Now, I think it's interesting. Part of what you do is the creating of apps.
That's right.
But a big at the heart of what you do is really teaching people, right?
That's
You're
right.
You're a training company at the heart of it.
So we do both, and they feed each other. So the things that we learn through developing apps for people, we then use to dig into our training programs and teach other people around the world how to do that. And it's interesting because we're actually, most of our training clients are out in Silicon Valley. So we train at Uber and Facebook and LinkedIn. We do some stuff for Amazon. And so we're actually much better known out on the West Coast than we are on the East Coast.
Now, but how did training get to be such an important part of your business?
So much of training these days is really inefficient, right? You go out into a strip mall and you do 8 hours, and it's the company that's putting it on. So it's mostly an advertising thing. It's not really technical training.
Right.
And it's nice to go and actually pay to be told the truth, to be told the most relevant things, not just what the vendor wants you to hear. And so we put a really experienced engineer at the front of the room to speak, not just a talking head. We make sure our materials are what you're actually going to be doing when you work on the platform we're teaching you. And we try and create an environment where you can really focus on what you're doing.
Now, when you started the business, was that always the emphasis?
That's where we started. So we did a training, and we always knew that consulting would be part of what we did. Mm-hmm. So we started off building systems here. Here in Atlanta, there's a company called TOPS, and they do an orthodontic practice management system. And that was our very first consulting client. So we developed a system for the Mac that enabled orthodontists to keep
track
of.
And you were based here in Atlanta?
We were based here in Atlanta the whole time.
And so how'd you find those people? Because that's an early
They came
adopter,
to training.
Right?
So
they came to a training.
Yeah,
they
so said, that's hey, a nice thing that the training also feeds back into the business is we get introduced to companies through that. So a lot of our companies that we work with, we originally started with training them.
So it's the concept of, hey, you can do this. Here's how to do it.
Right.
And then they're like, wow, this is way too hard. Can you do this for me?
Right. Or we're just a little overwhelmed. Maybe you can take these hard parts off of our plate and let us focus on the business logic of what we're doing.
Now, are your apps in and around a certain industry, or it can be a consumer app?
No, we'll do pretty much anything, and we actually really enjoy it. People come to us with hard engineering problems, and it's a great opportunity to step into their shoes and really think about how their business works and to create apps specifically for their business. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's valuable that we're here in the United States, right? A lot of people are starting to offshore their software development efforts. But because we're here, we can sit with you and we can understand your culture and we can understand where your company is going and where your competitors are going and help you create a product that fits your niche.
Now, are you finding more and more businesses where the app is actually the business?
Actually, the other way. When the app first thing happened, people were selling their apps and making a living selling a $1.99 app.
Right.
But nearly all our customers now are selling something else. So like when General Electric makes their C Smart lighting system. They need somebody to write the software that drives it. So we are the ones who stepped up and created the software to go with it. So you download the app for free, and you just pay for the light bulbs.
So now, what about the apps like an Uber app? Like Uber app is the business of Uber, right?
I guess you could say that really what people want are rides. They don't really want an app. Right. What they really want is a ride.
But that
you're paying for the ride.
You couldn't have a business.
For sure. And that's what we believe about all the apps that we write, is that it makes the business stronger. And in such a competitive landscape, you need to have the strongest platform that you can. And it's not just a ride. It's a whole platform of engagement and constantly improving, looking at analytics. How are people actually using it? So when we talk about big data, that's a process by which you're always getting better at what you do.
So now when you're working with a customer, you come in obviously knowing more about the app landscape than they do.
Right.
How do you kind of get them up to speed to have them understand this is what it could be? Like, you're looking at this too small.
Yeah.
Does that ever happen?
It does happen. But I'll tell you what's happening more and more is that we're seeing that this is sort of the golden age of the product managers. They call them product owners or platform owners or these sorts of ideas of what features go in. What is the audience that we're going after? Who is the competition? And it's a kind of a magical thing that these great product managers do. And so I had the great honor of getting to work with Steve Jobs at Next, and then when we were bought at Apple. And I can tell you that Steve was kind of a jerk. And a lot of the things that we know about managing people well and doing branding well, Steve was not good at all. But what Steve Jobs was great at, like world class, was recognizing great products and what features should go in and what should go out and who was the audience that he was really going to address. And I think that was the beginning of a new era where companies realized this product is central to what we're doing. It doesn't matter if we're Six Sigma if nobody wants our product. And so this is a new era. And so more and more we're coming in and we're being told these fantastic stories of where people see their business are going and how the technology we're creating fits in with that plan. And we have to stand on our tippy toes to make those visions reality, but that's what we love doing.
So walk me through the initial kind of conversation. How are they choosing you? Is it typically going in through training for themselves?
Sometimes it's training. A lot of it these days, because we've been in business for 18 years now, it's word of mouth. So people hear that they use somebody's product and they know somebody who works at the company and they say, how did this happen? And they say, we brought Big Nerd Ranch in. We're not a company that does a whole lot of advertising.
Right.
It's mostly word of mouth, and that's been really effective. We typically sell them on what's called the discovery sprint. And that's 2 weeks that you sit down with an engineer and a designer, and we go through and we look at what is this going to be when we're done. And we'll do wireframes to describe the user interface. We'll start talking about the data model. The engineer will talk about what's expensive and what's risky in the project. And when you get done with that, the client usually has a much clearer understanding of what will the product be and how much is it going to cost and what are the unknowns. When you build a building, you know, if you're over or under 10%, that's a big deal. Software is much riskier. It's because we've never done it before, right? We build a house. We've built lots of houses before. But when you come to us with your fantasy of what piece of software you'd like, it's never been created before. Otherwise, you would just buy it off the shelf.
Right.
And so often, the overages and unders can be a lot. And what we try and tell our clients is give them an idea of how risky is the thing that they're undertaking.
So, and the risk is around when you think you can do something, there's problems in actually executing it?
When you're writing something new, estimating is hard. And it's hard for all engineers. And engineers in particular are very, very optimistic. So we'll often say, yeah, this is going to take an afternoon. And then really 2 weeks later, we're still like, well, it was a little bit more complicated than I thought. And that's a risk. And we're getting better and better at it. But we always want the client to know, this is what we think it's going to take, but give or take.
So the engineering part is the coding part?
That's right, writing the code.
And then so when you're doing it, you're never using kind of off the shelf and then cobbling it together, everything is fresh?
If we can cobble a piece together, so often there will be a server-side piece that we'll be using, and it will have an API that your mobile app can talk to. That's the most common thing that we cobble together. Nearly everything else is custom.
And is that unusual in boutique firms like yours, or is that
That's why we're cool, because we're the alchemist who can take nothing and create something awesome.
But there's services out there that just kind of look for open source and then cobble it together and then put a skin on it to make it.
There are
kind
companies
of
that will do that, and if you have a real common task, so for example, a lot of people have tours that they want to do based on the iPhone. There are six companies out there that make a package where you can describe your walking tour of Charleston and upload it, and it will generate an app for you, and then you just put your name on it. And that certainly exists for the common sorts of applications. That's not typically what we get called in for.
So you're doing more higher end?
We're doing higher end stuff.
And then so then the company size that works with you is larger company, enterprise level company?
Yeah, a lot of the Fortune 10 companies in the world use Big Nerd Ranch, and that's been exciting working with big companies and helping them to be more nimble and learning about their cultures. We also have worked with startups. So Roadie here in Atlanta is a crowdsourced shipping company. And they brought us in because they had a marketing plan, but they didn't have an engineering team. And we actually wrote version one of their server, their mobile apps. And then we helped recruit and train their engineering team. They were actually working in our office for a while. And now they're off on their own. We help only every once in a while. But it was very exciting to help get that startup off the ground.
And then that's an example of how you work with the smaller companies. But if they have funding and they're backed, then that could be a good fit to work with you.
Exactly. We don't typically do an equity deal where you just come to us
right.
with some harebrained business plan.
Napkin. Right.
But if someone else is going to fund it, we're delighted to step in and help you create that.
And then Roadie has backing. Their UPS is involved with their
That's
organization.
Right.
So that makes them almost an enterprise.
So Mark Orland, who is the CEO there, also started Cabbage. So
right.
he has a great track record. And for him to raise money, it's not mm-hmm. that hard.
So now, for you, why do you still hang out here in Atlanta if a lot of your work's in Silicon Valley?
We have found that Atlanta is a great place to do this sort of work. Georgia Tech is a wonderful source of talent, so we hire a lot of young people coming out of that. There's a good industrial base here. So, for example, the GE office that we work with is right here in Atlanta. The airport, and a lot of people don't talk about the airport, but as a consulting company, it's great to be able to get
anywhere
in right. the world overnight. So it's been a treat working with Atlanta. It's a very pro-business. The cost of living is reasonable, right? If I had an employee force in Palo Alto,
right.
I'd have to pay them four times as much just so they could afford to live there.
So I have an apartment. So now, for you, how did you get to Next? Were you from here and then got to Next, or you were at Next and somehow got to Atlanta?
I was at Next and then I somehow came to Atlanta. So I was working on Wall Street on this thing that I thought nobody would ever care about in the early 90s, and it was mortgage-backed securities. And it turned out that this became a big deal. But we wrote the systems that controlled the workflow of the mortgage-backed securities on Next computers.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved working with the software. I had done military stuff before, and I was doing this. And so Next was the next natural step. So I applied and got a job there. And I was there for, you know, two years. And then we got bought by Apple. So I got to be an Apple employee for a little while. And then I decided it was time to start my own thing.
So you started doing the apps at that point?
Well, there was no iPhone at that point.
So that was
1997-ish.
So it was software.
So what we did was Mac work first.
Mm-hmm.
And we wrote the standard book on Mac development. We developed a bunch of applications. We did a lot of training. And then when the iPhone SDK came out, all the technologies were very similar. They were all the stuff we had developed at Next, basically. And so we were the natural people to step forward and train people on how to do iPhone programming. And then some of our clients came forward and said, we'd really like an Android application. So we did that. And then we needed to do servers. So we hired up a server team. And then we needed designers and product managers. So it's really become a one-stop shop. If you are a product manager who has a vision of what your digital product is going to be, you can come to Big Nerd Ranch and we can take care of the whole thing for you.
So now, has it been growing in the way you imagined?
So we were very spoiled. In the early days, we were the belle of the ball. And sales mainly involved just picking up the phone and somebody at the other end would be like, how big a check should I write? Which was awesome. Like, it was like printing money. But one of the tricky things is, your culture adapts to that. You go through a growth phase. You hire salespeople who are more like farmers than hunters.
Right.
And then it becomes more competitive, right? The people in Romania figure out how to write the apps. And a lot of people, companies start to see, well, this mobile thing is a long-term play. We should develop a Turner Networks team that just does mobile applications. They start to take it in-house. And so things got tighter. There's more competition, and we didn't adapt fast enough. So we got to be 110 people, and then we settled down to 70 people as our sales dried up. And then we've been growing again recently as we've really gotten our feet under us.
So now, being here in Atlanta, you've been able to tap into kind of the university system. You said the airport's important.
Mm-hmm.
But you're still going through word of mouth? That's still how you're growing?
Yeah. We certainly have smarter marketing efforts now. We've gone to much more account-based. So we'll identify particular companies that we think would be
the right fit
for us, and we will go after them specifically. And then once we get our foot in the door, we have account managers who will try and expand the footprint of what we're doing with them. So we've gotten much more account-based as opposed to what we were doing earlier, which was just about brand building, mm-hmm. that we wanted people to know who we were without focusing on who it really was.
And a lot of the materials you've printed or have written books around mm-hmm. are very technical.
Very.
Right? You're not kind of for everybody.
We're not. So if you are an engineer who's written software, but you've never worked on the platforms that we're good at, our books help you get onto that platform. Mm-hmm. So we can teach you how to do iPhone programming. We can teach you how to do Android programming. We can teach you how to do JavaScript programming. And so you can do that with the class, or you can do that with our books. Our books are available at Barnes & Noble. So just go down the shelf. You'll mm-hmm. see the Big Nerd Ranch guides to those things. Or you can come to our camp. And in 1 week, if you're already a programmer, let me make that clear. If you're already a programmer, in 1 week, we can make you an iPhone programmer or an Android programmer. And we also do corporate training. So we'll send an instructor to a company site. You can put 25 people in a room, and we'll turn them all into iPhone programmers or Android programmers.
Now, where do you see the kind of expansion of the app platform? Do you see more augmented reality and virtual reality and things like that?
We're so excited about augmented and virtual reality. We think it's a great way to do training, for example, for people. So we're looking more and more at VR and AR, augmented reality and virtual reality. There's a platform called Unity, which was for making video games, but it's actually perfect for developing these AR and VR applications. So we're dedicating more of our efforts to learning Unity and helping clients with that. We're also looking at the conversational interfaces, so making Alexa skills and Google Assistant skills. And those translate pretty naturally to chatbots as well. Mm-hmm. So there's very interesting user interface questions about that. We really liked for the person to say, well, show me all the McDonald's near me. And actually listing that out, for example, is a nightmare on these conversational platforms. Right. Nobody wants that. So we have to think hard about how do we get people to the data they need as quickly as possible.
The clarity in communication just without computers is difficult.
That's right. So you among people.
Right. So you have to be very precise in your language.
Yeah. So we're writing some of those. If you have one of the beds that sits up, motorized beds,
right,
the Alexa skill that does that, we wrote it for those companies.
So now, what are you most excited about?
It's a really exciting time, right? We have taken care of some of the low-lying fruit already with moving to the cloud. So it used to be you had to run your own servers, and now it's really easy to get Google take care of it and the scaling and the security. We're dealing now with DevOps, which makes it super easy to move software, test it, integrate it in with what already exists, and roll it out so companies can do it every day, push a new version up to the cloud. We're now dealing with questions about machine learning. So how do we optimize things to better serve the customer over time as the system learns? And I think that's going to be huge.
What about like 5G, like having access to more speed and more bandwidth?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's exciting that in places where that's going to be available, that you're going to have that sort of pipe to move data down.
But
really, what we're
things?
Talking, what our clients are more interested in is reaching the next billion users. So when you talk about developing nations, that's where most of our customers are really excited, is that every day, you know, 100,000 people who have never had a computer before go out and buy a phone in Africa. And that's a market that they're eager to get hold of. And so questions around that are really interesting. How do you write apps that you use less electricity? Because those phones are now available, but you don't want to use too much power because they right. burn it up. So if you look at Facebook has a version that's a Facebook Lite, which is specifically for developing nations. It uses 1/100th the amount of data going back and forth. It uses 1/3 the power when it's running as the regular Facebook app. And so our clients are really thinking about that next billion, not the spoiled people who have 5G. It's people who have intermittent access, who have don't speak English, who may not be able to read. It's a very exciting time to reach new audiences. The other audience they're really interested in is older users. So older users now have smartphones. They're beginning to download apps. They're starting to find services that are interesting to them. How do we design things better for older users so that, you know, like all the hip designers came from print. And they love like a gray text on a blue background with a really skinny line.
Right.
Older Americans can't see that. They can't read that text. So we're having to go back and create things that are not necessarily as beautiful in the designer's mind, but are actually functional for the audiences we're trying to reach.
So now, so it seems like there's a lot of, it's like what's old is new again, right? So in some ways you're having to kind of, I don't want to say dumb down, but just make more basic functional features. As
sure.
elegant as you can,
yeah.
to reach an audience that is new to this technology.
Exactly.
Even though
right.
the technology is 10, 15 years old.
Right. And sometimes it's two different versions of the app. So you'll do the complex version and you'll do the simplified version.
Right.
And so in time, the user will become a more powerful user and they'll decide they want to upgrade to the pro power mm-hmm. version of the app. Yeah.
And then also you're working in payments. I would imagine that payments are important in those markets as well.
Payments are huge in Atlanta. I mean, we're the center of all the credit card payments.
But overseas, the payments are in play also. They have to have yeah. these microtransactions in order to make a lot of those apps worth doing, right?
That's true. Once again, a lot of our customers are selling something else. So GE is selling light bulbs and we give the app away. So
right.
there's no payments that go through the app. And of course, all the people who, you know, Google and Apple, they take their tax on everything that goes through the app. So as much as possible, our clients are trying to make sure that the money is paid through their AT&T UVerse account or they pay for it at Lowe's.
So now, if somebody wants to have more substantive conversation and learn more about how you can serve them, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Go to bignerdranch.com. Our phone number is there. We'd love to talk to you. You can follow us on Twitter. We're always looking for new clients and new challenges.
And new developers.
And we're also hiring. We're always hiring.
We're always looking for talent, right?
Always looking
That's
for talent.
A never-ending
What a
challenge.
Treat that we get to hire smart young people and give them interesting challenges to work on.
Well, Aaron, thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Lee, it's a pleasure.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, I got Jim Crone with Accrue Insurance. Welcome.
Hey, good morning.
Tell us about Accrue. How are you helping the world?
We are a... it's interesting. I'll call myself a startup only because our business has actually developed within the last 2 years. I've been in this particular line of business for, I'm entering my 27th year. But most recently, I partnered with some good folks that have put together our own insurance agency. And what we found is we're able to deliver customized insurance solutions for individuals and heretofore, in the last 2+ years that we've been active with our own insurance agency, we've really partnered with other trusted advisors. And that's been a very key component of who we are, what we've done, and how we've developed so far.
So how do you define trusted advisor? Like, who's a trusted advisor in your ecosystem?
So in large part, we're talking to primarily financial planners because they are the ones who are largely charged with taking a client from where they are, managing those assets, and then getting them where those plans are developed for. And many times we integrate with that financial planning firm to be able to answer those specific insurance questions that can really either muck up a plan or can really make the plan work well. And that would be one. The others are the CPAs, the
bankers,
definitely attorneys. So we partner with a wide swath of folks, but a key component would be that large financial planner, that planner that's charged with really managing the client's overall portfolios and everything that goes with it.
Because the planner is typically the quarterback for the individual.
Right. And so they look at us like we are to come in and really provide obvious guidance related to insurance issues. And most of what we find ourselves doing currently is reviewing existing products. Mm-hmm. We throw around terms like Hillcrester or an optimizer. So a Hillcrester in our language would be somebody who's entering or coming out of one season and entering into a new season. So they have maybe existing things that have gotten them where they are, but they need to really reevaluate and adjust and make sure that those are set for their future.
So now, are your clients typically people who work for like large companies, or are they entrepreneurs that have their own business?
Very much flavored for entrepreneurs. And so those are the ones who really get the opportunity to get a real value brought to them, whether it's, again, through a planner or the attorney or through, you know, CPAs. So it's very much really centering around that entrepreneur.
And then is your insurance offering, is it typically just insurance for the company, or is it, could it be long-term insurance for them and their family? Like what types of insurance? It's not car insurance, right?
Correct.
Or could be that too?
Our focus really is when you break it down, it's for life insurance, long-term care insurance, disability insurance, and to what degree maybe that's necessary would be annuities, when, where, and how they might fit. We do stay in that space, and we don't do those other versions of insurance, but it's those versions of insurance that do fit well within a larger context. And so we understand the larger plan, and we work specifically with those other advisors to make sure that anything that we do in the insurance, one, advances the goal for whatever the client's trying to accomplish, and secondly, we want to make sure that whatever they do doesn't muck up what things might be doing, might they be doing.
Right, so everybody's kind of working together on behalf of the customer.
Right. And our delivery is really to dig deep and provide an independent list of insurance providers to bring whatever knowledge we have about the specifics of those products and fit them into the larger plan.
And then when you're working with that kind of mentality, then you're kind of watching their back like, hey, this could be a good solution, but in your tax bracket, this may not be a good solution.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And so many times we find ourselves integrating, you know, evaluating something that might already be in existence. And they say, gosh, I'm getting this notification and I don't know how this might fit. And many times we start with a question of, why did you buy this in the first place? And many times it's often met with, I don't know. So we help
what
go
I had
through
before.
That. Yeah, it's kind of, hey, this is what I've had. This is
or
what I've
my
done.
My neighbor said I should have this.
Yeah, so we do take a lot of proactive steps to dig deep. We have some tools that allow us to easily access specific information that helps us profile and measure what we think is the best option available in the market so that we can now go back to the client and then also to the other advisors and make sure that it fits into the bigger picture.
Now, do you work with other insurance firms?
We certainly have access to any and all insurance companies that we're an independent provider.
So you're independent?
Yes, we're very much independent. We last year we did business with 16 different insurance companies, and so we very much focus on the client need and then march out to the market, find the product that best fits the situation, and then bring it back to deliverable.
And then when you talk about these partnerships with trusted advisors, other than kind of the thought leadership and kind of being the go-to people in insurance, are there any other ways that you guys work together?
Many times we have found ourselves, there's a particular area that we have put some emphasis in, and that's what we'll call the non-qualified deferred compensation strategies. It happens to be an area that I've worked in for a number of years. And so many times with those other advisors who are delivering tax advantage vehicles for their clients, typically in the small business arena, they're offering things like 401k plans or strategic advantages that are available for the business as well as the employees and also the owners that give tax advantage. And then we might take that to the next step and say, hey, there are added advantages for something called non-qualified businesses or non-qualified plans that can be added to something that it adds some retirement planning for those top-tiered individuals.
Do you have any strategies to help a business kind of retain their best talent?
Absolutely. And that's exactly where those non-qualified benefit plans. And so, you know, the qualified plans are available. They have to be available for all employees. And with that, they come there are limits from the government that are pointed to that particular type of plan. But the non-qualified benefits allow for companies to selectively pick those individuals that are really key drivers. We're seeing a huge swing now, not so much in the last 4, 5, 10, 8 years, with businesses that have gone through the swoon. We're seeing now them coming out. They want to figure out how to retain the talent they've got, their top tier. And then secondly, they also, in this tight labor market, are trying to figure out how do you add new talent. And those non-qualified benefit plans are very key to help them do that.
So now when you're having those type of strategic conversations, how does that kind of happen? Because they probably didn't come in to ask you questions about that when they first meet you guys.
No, that's a very good point. So many times it might start with recognizing some of the limits that are there in their qualified plans or their 401k plans. They might find that they're not able to do the kind of things for themselves and their top-tiered key people. And it might be that something triggers it because there's a limit that the government puts on those qualified plans. And so that might be the starting point of the conversation to say, well, let's talk about how can you take full advantage of some tax strategies that are much more complementary to the owner as well as that top-tier management.
So when you first work with somebody, typically they've had another insurance person. Right.
Yeah.
So they're switching for some reason. How does that onboarding kind of work?
We have a tool that we've created that really helps.
You need an app.
Yeah. I might talk there.
You definitely need an app.
I know. I seriously was thinking through that because anyway, the aspect that we have is a tool that we've created through some, you know, basic formatting. That does allow us to easily gather the information we need. And what we found is that has been an enormous valuable benefit for us because it gives us the tools that we need, the access to the information we need, so that we can anonymously and independently go into the insurance market, find the best options that we can find to bring back to the client and then the other advisory team. And that just has infinitely helped us with our business model. It's a clear distinction that we have that allows us to separate ourselves because we don't behold to a particular company or a particular product. We fit the solution, but understanding the details of that client situation is imperative.
Now, what happens is then they make the change, then they start working with you, but at some point you're going to have to dig deeper and know what these ancillary kind of challenges they might be having. So how do you meet with them quarterly? How do you kind of stay abreast on what their changing needs are?
Sure. It is an iterative thing. We make sure that we have direct, clear contact with the client, but also because of the relationship that we have with their advisors, more specifically, maybe it might be one or two of their financial advisors, we very much find that that's the tool that allows us to make sure that this plan, when we start, is maintained and implemented. I just was working with a client that we started a plan on 9 years ago, and we're making adjustments to that plan as we speak because things change.
Sure.
So
now, how do you kind of stay on top of the different trends, like if there's changes in the regulatory area or tax challenges?
We stay very plugged in to what happens from a regulatory, and that really is just resources that we have and have developed over the last several years. I belong to many different associations, professional associations. There's a group in Atlanta called Exit Planners Institute, which is a consortium of a whole bunch of different categories of advisors. And I very much find that, you know, interacting with others is a very key to make sure that I'm clear with what's going on in the industry and what goes on with how businesses are viewing it. As I said, 3 or 4 years ago, non-qualified benefit plans were just not much happening there because their businesses were much more focused on just staying alive and retaining what they had. And so today, our conversations have very much switched where they do want to see, they see a better platform going forward, and they want to figure out how to keep that talent they have or get the new talent.
Now, how do you stay connected with the whole kind of entity? Like I recently we had some financial people on, and I was doing some research, and I found out that the vast majority of children of the client of financial planners go elsewhere. Like
That's very true.
It's like 60 or 70%.
That's very true.
And that seems like a missed opportunity for a firm that has invested all this time and decades.
That's true.
To just say, okay, we're okay with 2 out of 3 people leaving.
Right. Well, much of the specific product deliverables that we bring, insurance focused, are very much they're strategic planning opportunities for the client, mm-hmm. but they very much impact the next generation. Right. So life insurance has a very meaningful impact, right?
Exactly.
Or even things like long-term care insurance. It has a meaningful impact for the retaining of the assets for the current client. But we are very much open, and we work with our planning advisors to take that to that next generation and say, hey, look, mom and dad have done X, Y, Z, and this is for your benefit. And so we talk through that so that they can, one, be aware, but secondly, they can be that next connection to, at least from the planner's standpoint of when issues happen, they're able to pick it up and take it to that next level for the next generation.
Now, is there any kind of low-hanging fruit for companies if they want to kind of retain their superstars? It's those non-qualified. Do you think that's the play nowadays?
Yeah, we've developed a little bit of a template that we've introduced and have found successful when we've brought it to our different clients. It might be nonprofit organizations. It might be for-profit organizations. But the template is they start from the standpoint of saying, hey, we have a key group of individuals we want to retain. And so our template starts with, here are maybe 3 different types of non-qualified benefit plans that are available in the market. And we walk them through the pros and cons of each. And then really say, here is what we think is best appropriate and most appropriate for you, given all of your goals and objectives of strategic, what you're trying to accomplish for your corporation. And then we would take them through a modeling of what that would look like for them, both from the cash flow standpoint as well as the tax incentive standpoint, and really just kind of help them all the way through. And then to the degree they want to make the implementation, that's when we just fill in the blanks.
Now, if you are one of the list of trusted advisors, what would be a good reason to add you to kind of their roster?
I've seen in my 27 years focusing on insurance, I've seen things that work and I've seen things that don't work. And I'm very open and candid with ability to go to that, whether it's the client or the other advisor, and say, hey, here's a strategic thing that I understand the logic, but it's not going to work. And I think that's probably one of the more distinctive things that we can deliver. I've seen things, as I say, that work and some that don't.
So you're out there looking for trusted advisors,
sure.
Right? You're looking to serve more of those, right? Because you want to be the go-to insurance folks.
Right. And we're happy to put all of our wares on the table and say, look, as the independent insurance provider, our focus is, one, really getting to know all the facts and circumstances that we can, and then take that through a process so that we can get to the end of saying, it's not about this product being the only answer for you. It's about, let's fit a product.
So it integrates in the overall.
Absolutely.
Plan.
It's got to really start from the plan And we are a deliverable of that. So,
and then if you're a person out there, a business owner, whether it doesn't matter if you're an S corp or C corp, any type of business owner, right?
That's right. There are advantages. Look, the accountants will speak into
right.
What are the added advantages for this company format or that company format. We take whatever that is and say, okay, well, this plan may be best suited to fit inside of an S corp or a partnership. Doesn't fit well, you know, in a C corp type
right.
scenario. So those are things that, again, having seen and worked in the arena for long enough to be able to get to that answer, we can get to there quickly.
But if you're a business owner and your insurance person hasn't been around for a while, that's probably not. It's probably time to start looking for other services.
Yeah, there is a lot of that that we've found ourselves coming into. You know, insurance too many times has been that vehicle where it's the one and done solution.
Right. It's a set and forget it, and you never hear from them again.
And that term we used before, the Hillcrester, right? That's a person who's entering out of one season of life, entering into a new season. And it's very important to measure what you have and make sure that that's very well aligned with what you want in
right.
the future.
And where you're at and how are you going to get there?
Yeah. And so we get there, help them get there.
So if somebody wants to learn more, what's the website for you guys?
It's www.accruinsurance.com, and that's A-C-R-U insurance.com.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Thank you.
All right. The headliner. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, Sam Ofer with Ideal Diamond. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, tell us about Ideal Diamond. How are you serving folks?
So Ideal Diamond, we started the business about 30 years ago. At that particular point, we were just strictly wholesale, supplies strictly to the jewelry stores and to the wholesale trade.
Mm-hmm.
About 5, 6, 7 years ago, we started making a little change and decided to start selling to the public too, which caused us a little bit problem with the jewelry stores because we sold them, you know, to the public for the same price as we sold it to the jewelry stores. The advantage that we have being Ideal Diamond here in Atlanta is the fact that I myself go and buy the rough, the raw diamond straight. We used to do it from Africa. We don't do it anymore because there's a conflict diamonds. So now right. we buy it from Russia. I then take it to my cutting factory back home in Israel, and I cut it, and then I sell it. So I'm the first hand on the diamond. Usually when you go to a jewelry store, you have about five, six, seven hands before the jeweler get it. Everybody make 5-6% on the way. By the time you get it, it's probably 100% more than it should cost.
So now you're considering yourself a private jeweler. Like yes. You're my guy.
Right.
Like Jim's my insurance guy. Aaron's my app guy.
Right.
You're my diamond guy.
The diamond guy. You always need a diamond. we came with the concept of private jeweler means it's not a jewelry store that you walk in and every time you walk in you see a different salesperson. The salespeople in the jewelry stores, most of them sold different product, insurance maybe, before. Now they say, okay, we're going to sell some jewelry, be a salespeople. So it's not really private connection. You come to us, we are family-owned business. We don't have any salespeople. We don't have any commission people. So it's very relaxed. It's in the office in Sandy Springs. You sit next to me or next to one of my associates. And we really take you and explain to you everything about the diamond. Everybody talked to you about the 4C, the color and the clarity and the carat weight, but this is really only 20% of what it's all about. There's a lot of things to do with certification, with the way the diamond is cut. Most of the jewelers do not want to talk to you about it. They don't want you to know about it because the more you know, the more danger you are. They want you to say nothing. Look at it, says it's beautiful, it's shiny. Who do I write a check to? That's a good client. We operate different.
So now you're really educating your clients and you're really helping them get the look and that they're trying to get.
Yes. It's
personal.
Very personal. No pressure. The fact that I'm handling the diamond from the state of Mother Nature all the way to the finished product, There's not too many people like me that can do that and explain everything on the way. We go through everything and explain to you how best diamond will fit your need.
And then, so are you targeting primarily the man or the woman, or your clients both?
You know, things change in the last years. It used to be only the man and a surprise. Now, I say 40% of them come together.
Together.
Another idea, they come with their mother-in-law. But that's a bad idea. Okay, the mother-in-law says, why don't you get a little something bigger than that? You know, it's my daughter. She wants more than that.
Right.
So, but it's good. You know, we deal with that. I see a lot of men come with their mother.
Their own mother?
With their own mother. It's very nice. You know, she's there, you know, to help him. And
moral support.
Moral support. And then it works the other way. Oh, you shouldn't spend that much on her. So we see both ways. People come to me, usually they have absolutely no idea what, you know, and I go with them and I said, look, if you have a budget for that, you know, the 2 months and the 3 months met, I don't believe in that. I think everybody should have whatever is comfortable to spend.
Right.
And they said, okay, we want to spend X amount of money. I said, okay, do you have any particular setting that you want that she show you? Usually what the women do is they tell their best friend what they like, and then they communicate with their fiancé. That's what she likes. She told me.
Don't they just see like some celebrity and say, I want one that looks like that?
They do that too. Sometimes they come with pictures.
Magazines.
Three different magazine pictures. They said, okay, this is what you want. She's very... high maintenance. I said, okay. He said, she wants the top of this ring, the side of this ring, and the bottom part of that ring. We take it and we create it.
So you're creating it from scratch?
From scratch.
It's all custom.
It's all custom made. And what a nice thing we do something called the CAD. And the CAD, the computer CAD, is actually we create the on-ring on a 3D.
On a computer.
On a computer. We email it to you. You look at that, and you either approve it or don't approve it or make changes. So you are actually in charge of every step of the way of making the ring. We're not just giving you a price a day. That's yours. You buy it. You do it yourself.
So now this is a totally different than like a mall experience, right?
Yeah, it's completely different than like a mall experience because you sit with us and, you know, we very, if you want to say homey, we sit in a small office, not in a jewelry store. And the most important thing to most of the people beside the services we give is the price. And because we are the first one that touched the diamond and there is nobody in between, we will be usually more than half than whatever you can get it.
So not only is it accustomed to exactly what I want, it's much less expensive?
It's usually less than half the price of whatever you can get it. But you have to understand, I tell people, they tell me, why it's so expensive? You know, I went to this guy and this guy. I said, where did you hear about him? On the radio. I said, okay. Well, these people spend $1 million in advertising. Somebody got to pay for it.
So that's what they're paying? Like when you...
Part of the price of the diamond is what is involved in getting it to your ears.
Right.
Which is radio advertising, TV advertising, paying extremely high rent on a very high-rise building.
Or in the mall. That has to be super mall. Expensive, right?
The mall is not even the high rent. It's also a percentage to the mall of the sale.
They have to give a percentage to the mall?
Percentage to the mall of everything that they sell. So even if they don't make a high markup, still, okay, what the rent is $45,000 a month. My commission sales people, they make 10%. Then I have to give to the mall 15%. I got to mark it up.
Right. So now for you, you get personal, you're going to create the diamond, or is it only rings, or it could be any jewelry?
We do everything. With us, it's like a Catholic marriage. You can't divorce us.
So it could be anything. It could be bracelets, necklaces, anything. And it's not just diamonds. It's other precious
it's
gems.
Everything. We specialize in diamond, but we do everything. 99% of our clients, when they buy something from us, they come for everything for us.
Mm-hmm.
And diamonds are our priority. So the nice fact about you coming up and picking up a diamond, then we're making the ring for you, is the fact that when we make the ring, we match the same stones at the ring as a center stone.
Oh, with instead the next thing.
Exactly. So instead of just buying a ring and just put the diamond in it, we match the quality of the diamonds in the ring to the center stone. Some people don't know. They said, you know, I want to surprise her. You know, I don't know what rings to get her. You know, me and you might love it and she might hate it.
Right.
I have a solution for that too.
What is that?
I take the diamond and I put it in a beautiful white gold Tiffany ring and I give it to them as a loaner. I said, you don't pay for the ring, just for the diamond. Give it to her.
Just try it.
Then come back together with her, let her pick whatever she wants, because what me and you might love, she might hate.
Right. So now, do you work a lot with celebrities and athletes and things like
yes,
that?
Yes, yes. Before we went already open to the public, we were involved heavily with, we still are, with rappers and football players and that kind. They are very private people.
Sure.
And they don't want anybody to know their
own business.
Right,
they don't want to be at the mall pointing at things.
Exactly, and they walk into the jewelry store, and right before you know, they're on the news that they went to the jewelry store. So they come to us. And the nice thing about them, you do one good by one, you get them all. They all send each other.
So now, what's been the most rewarding part of you about this business? You've been in this, is most of your career has been in this industry?
Yes, my last 40 years has been that. And, you know, it's a rewarding business because you make people happy.
Right.
So some businesses you don't make people happy. Here you make, well, the guys are not that happy to write a check. But, you know, we see it all. We see things like guys don't want to even get, not a lot, very few, don't want to get involved in that process at all. So they just give a check, sign it, give it to the girl, said, go shop, buy whatever you want, leave me alone. I don't have time for that. No. So, but I don't think this is the right way to go.
So now, for you, if you were to educate someone who's never bought a diamond, what would be kind of the do's and don'ts?
Right. So I say, do not buy from a mall store. If you buy a diamond, buy from maybe, I suggest a mom and pop shop. Mm-hmm. I think I found them to be the most honest and the most reliable. Unless you can find somebody, you know, which is a wholesaler, but not that easy to find. I said, don't ever buy a diamond which is already set in a ring, because some stones have a little flaws on the side or even are chipped on the side.
Oh, they can't see clearly.
And you cannot see it because there's a prong sits on the top of it.
Right.
Then one day you want to change the setting, you take the diamond out and say, oh, there's a chip. And you're back to the jewelry store and said, oh, you
I
broke.
I was there, right.
I wasn't there before. So I would also say, go for the size. But without giving too much on the quality. So I wouldn't say go and buy the best quality. We usually sell all these diamonds to the Asian market, to Shanghai, which we have an office in Shanghai too. Mm-hmm. The Asian people like flawless white stones. They are very superstitious people. And they believe there is flaws in the diamonds, there is flaws in the marriage life. Oh. So that's good for us. We sell them there. Here.
So they might take a smaller stone that's higher quality.
Exactly. They would take a half a carat instead of a carat and a half, but they would buy the best of the best for the same money. I say always go in between. Go for a white stone. You don't have to buy the best color, just white. Buy a stone which have a couple of small flaws in it. If you can't see with the naked eye, nobody's going to take a loop or a microscope and go next to your wife's finger. And if they do, you're in trouble. They're too close to her.
Right.
So that's what I suggest to do. And always, you know, fit the budget to your need. Don't go over. Don't go crazy. You can always upgrade it at any time.
And then are there any trends? Is there new shapes or new colors? Or
right now, a cushion cut has been very popular. A cushion cut is a stone that the first shape that the stone was ever cut to. So it's not exact square. It's not exact round. It's not exact an oval. It's kind of a roundish, squarish. That's popular right now. Round stone, circle stones, has always been number one in our sales. It's always been the most popular. Always been number one, and I think, in my opinion, always going to be number one. So most people go with round stone. As far as setting goes, the halo, which means small stones around the center stone, is very popular. There is some people that are very happy with this idea. I say like this, if you get yourself a nice size stone, carat, carat and a half, 2 carat, I wouldn't put anything around it because the stone makes a statement
by
itself.
Right?
Yes. If you buy a small stone, you want to judge it up a little bit. Okay. I agree with that.
So now, for you, how do you get your business if you're not advertising? It's just word of mouth of happy customers?
Well, our business consists of a few hundred jewelry stores around the United States and around the world. So
you sell the jewelry stores?
Yeah, we sell the jewelry
stores. But also here in Atlanta?
Here in Atlanta, we also supply quite a few people, jewelry stores. We also supply many, many, many around the world. Mm-hmm. So our bread and butter is jewelry stores and wholesalers that we sell to. Our private clientele is by appointment only. Usually it's 95% referral. And now with our new website, we hope to get some more people in and do that.
So now when the jewelry stores around the world, the reason they would pick you as opposed to another wholesaler is your experience and your connections?
Well, it's connection is number one. We know each other for 30, 40 years. Number two, we specialize in a item which is called Ideal Cut. Ideal Cut, like our company, Ideal Diamond. Ideal Cut is when the stone is cut to a perfection. You cannot tell it about every stone. The stone have to live to a certain perimeters to be called Ideal Cut. And that perimeters you verify when you buy a stone, which is certified by the lab, mm-hmm. which is another tip that I want to give to our listeners, that you need to buy a stone which is always certified by a lab. Do not buy a stone without paperwork. It's like buying a car without a title.
Right.
And on the certificate, you can see all the parameters of the Ideal Cut, which we will explain to you when you come to us how to look for it.
So you're out there trying to find more mom-and-pop jewelers to use you as their wholesaler, or do you sell to the big mall chains too?
Well, there is two ways we do it. The little mom-and-pop shops don't really have the money to buy the diamonds. So you go in and you said, okay, I have $10,000 to spend, and I want to buy it. And I want, my client is... You go to the jeweler, to the mom and pop shop. You said, I want to spend $10,000 and I want a 2K. The mom and pop shop will then tell you, okay, what's your name? What's your phone number? We're going to contact you. They call somebody like me. I take three stones. They say they want to spend $8,000, $9,000. They want to make $1,000 profit. I take two or three stones. I put them in FedEx, UPS, overnight it, anywhere in the United States. The next day they call you. You come in. They show you the three stones. You pick up one stone. They said the other two back with a check. So it's called consignment. Mm-hmm. So they work on consignment, or we call it memo in the business. That's how 90% of the business is done.
Wow. So isn't that a risk on your part? Yes. Or that's relationships?
They're saying if you can take the heat, get out of the kitchen, right? There's a risk. There's a risk on everything. But, you know, we know about these people for a long time, and it's mostly very honest people. Uh-huh. So that's about 90% of the business. The other 10% of the business is just straight selling. So we sell it to wholesalers and diamond dealers that have the money to buy inventory.
And they just buy.
They just buy straight up.
Right. And they say, I want 10 carat.
Yeah. What do you have between carat and 2 carats and rounds and cushions? Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. We have that. They just buy it for stock. And then we give them 60, 90 days terms to pay. And usually it's done by the time. So mom and pop shops are our bread and butter. All the diamonds are consignment. As a matter of fact, about 75% or 80% of the diamonds that you see here in Atlanta jewelry stores don't belong to the jewelry store.
It's
all consignment.
Really?
So some big dealers, they just take 20 stone, give it to ex-jeweler, said, here, sell it for me. After a month, what did you sell? This one, this one, this one. Send us a check. We send you a new batch, fresh.
And they send those somewhere else?
They send it to another store. So we have also this in our office. We have one guy that all he does is just manage the inventory, move stones from another place to another place.
And then can you tell it's the same stone? How can you tell?
Well, that's a good question. There's not two diamonds that I like. So if one stone is a 1.48 carat, it goes on the scale, it's 1.48, that's the stone. Then the floor, there's a black dot at 4 p.m. You look with the microscope, you see that the black dot is 4 p.m.,
so there's markers to identify them.
Yeah, and then we look at the certificate and we look at the plot of the stone and we see the same dot at 4 p.m. That's the stone. Now, the technology came into play. A few years ago, most of the labs, what they do is they put the certificate number, which is 8 to 10 digit, they inscribe it with laser on the side of the stone.
Really?
Yes. And then you can look with the microscope when you get a stone. Look
so
at
that's
the certificate.
Simple. Right.
Yeah, and that verifies.
Now that's a flaw, though, in the diamond, right?
It's not a flaw. It's inscription. funny that you say, like, the Asian market don't want the numbers on it.
Exactly.
We don't want laser on this. Right. But people feel very comfortable that fits that, because people said, Sam, you show me a certificate, you show me a diamond.
Right.
How do I know that belongs? Now you can look. But there's another step. Then they said, well, excuse me for asking, but how do I know the guy that set the stone for you didn't switch it, okay, in my ring? Okay. So then when you come to pick up the ring, we have a tool. We put the ring with the stone set in it, and you look through the viewer, and you see your stone set in the ring with a number. There's also a big myth about stone switching. I have never seen that. I think I just heard it. I don't think really that happened. Maybe here and there. What people do now is they go to a jeweler. They said, look, here's the ring. Can you please clean it for me, buff it for me, or size it for me? I want to tell you something. You know, when I bought the stone, I'm a person that have all kind of fears. One of my fears is those stories about switching stone. So I bought a diamond that have the number inscribed on it. So if you don't mind, look at the number, make sure it's there. And if you don't mind,
tell me
when I pick it up, I want to see that's the one. I tell people, I said, if the jeweler get upset and start having issue with this, it's time for you to take it and go somewhere else, because he's got something to hide.
Exactly. So now, what's the best way to clean a diamond?
Best way to clean the diamond is if you can force yourself or make yourself twice a week, just take some Windex, spray underneath, and take an old toothbrush and go between the prongs. That's the best way and the cheapest way. Don't buy jewelry cleaners and don't buy all the stuff. I think it's a waste of money. Most of the people don't do it twice a week, three times a week. And after 6-7 months, the ladies from the cream, they put on the finger, right. And all of a sudden it's no show. What happened to diamond? There's no shine. Well, it's dirty. So then you bring it to us. We offer once a year a free maintenance on the ring. We clean it professionally. We buff it. Take all the scratches out of the ring, if there is any. And we steam it and we make it shiny. So,
and then Windex. Looks like brand new.
Looks like brand new. You got it yesterday, and it's free for the rest of your life.
So now, if you're in Atlanta and want a diamond, they should come to your shop, right? Or make an appointment.
They should call me, make an appointment, come to our office. It's a private office, and they're going to feel very comfortable. I have a lot of people that come and says, I asked them, I said, did you shop around? No.
No.
I said, do me a favor. I mean, it's against my business to tell you. Can you do me a favor and shop around a little bit?
So you get an idea.
So you come back and say, Sam, oh my God. Yeah. So, yeah. So, you know, don't ever go for people that give you pressure like, this price is good for right now. And if you don't buy it now, then these people you don't want the business with.
Right.
I tell my people, the prices that I give you right now are good for now and for the next 10 years. The only thing I don't guarantee is that I have the stone.
Right.
But the prices are guaranteed for lifetime.
And if somebody wanted to go to the website, what is it? It's a brand new, fresh website.
Yeah, it's a brand new. It's www.idealdiamond.com.
Good stuff. Well, Sam, thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Thank you.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Katie Galley. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.